Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
The best of 2024
on FUPAR Radio.
Just a warning that the clip you're about to hear might be disturbing for some people. Have a listen to this. You just heard a video there that has gone viral showing a uniformed male police officer holding a taser over a man who was lying on the ground at Terminal 2 of Manchester Airport before kicking him in the head twice. Well, Greater Manchester Police have now confirmed that an officer has been removed from all duties after, quote, a thorough review of further information of the incident, which took place on Tuesday. Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, who has met the Home Secretary over the incident, has appealed for calm following a protest at a police station in Manchester. After the meeting, Yvette Cooper said she understood the widespread distress the footage has caused, adding she had spoken to the police about the urgent steps that they are taking. Well, joining us now to discuss this situation is Henry Bolton, a former police officer who was leader of the UKIP between 2017 and 2018. He's now president of Primrose League, an organisation promoting conservative values. Henry, thanks so much for joining us. You've been a former police officer as well as a political leader. Policing has often been in the spotlight over the last 5 to 10 years, with many saying policing in Britain is broken. Do you agree, following the most recent footage, that policing in Britain is broken?
If you want an answer in one word, yes. But of course, there's nuances to this, and there's, you know, not everything is broken about the British Police Service. But fundamentally, there is a problem, I believe. It's some 25 years since I served, and in that time, I believe that standards, particularly in training, have gone downhill rapidly and have gone downhill a long way. And I think, you know, we've all seen videos. I mean, in the world of social media and everybody's got a smartphone and so on, you know, these things are all videoed. And we've seen far too often videos which obviously the police are in a difficult situation. There's confrontation, there's adrenaline on both sides of whatever altercation. But we have seen the police behave or respond in often ways that don't cover them in glory. And I think that's what we saw in part in the video footage, the short clips. We haven't got the full context, of course, the short clips that have emerged from Manchester. The basis, Ali, just quickly on that, for why we've seen that decline in standards, I believe, is because starting with Tony Blair, continued with Gordon Brown, and then accelerated under David Cameron's premiership with Theresa May as the Home Secretary, we saw the closure of institutional regional police training colleges. So we saw the end of residential, institutional, professional training for the police. And we saw it passed instead to academic centres of education, the universities. And the police now, their training really is limited institutionally to online training modules and every now and again a training day in their force area. It is simply inadequate to prepare officers to do these sort of things. And I hold police officers to higher standards than members of the public. So when members of the public say, well, look, these people, you know, had it coming to them, I don't know whether they did or not. I don't know what they did to bring about this police response or a police response. I just don't know. So I'm not judging any of that. But I simply believe that the police are not trained sufficiently well to deal with these things. And it is not good enough. You can't just say, well, you know, if it was my wife or my girlfriend, I would respond in this way. Police officers are officers of the law. They are to be held at the very highest of standards. They are an example setter. And we don't want to see them being judge, jury and executioner just because the public wants to see retribution because of something somebody's done. So I think, you know, we've got to have a big conversation about how we deal with this image problem and behavioural problem.
So on this issue of training, the police officers in the video were firearm police, which you all know will have a higher level of training than almost any other officer in a very, very difficult area, which is an airport. You talk about training, and I think your response there was highly focused on training. The reality is many of us will have seen the person in the video who is being kicked is clearly of an ethnic minority in an airport, which is often where a lot of allegations of racism come. A former chief superintendent to the Met Police, Dal Babu, told BBC Radio 4 that the police's actions were appalling and unnecessary, and in his opinion, racism played a part in the incident. Louise Casey's report pointed to institutional racism of the Metropolitan Police. It's not just training, is it? It's a racism problem in the police.
I have no, in the videos that I've seen, I have to say, hand on heart, that I see no indication of any behaviour resulting from a racist attitude. I just don't see that in those videos.
Henry, we're not going to ignore that it was, we're not going to ignore that it was a Muslim family in an airport. Let's not put our fingers in our ears and our hands over our eyes.
That was a contributory. I'm not prepared to say that that was a contributory factor to what happened. That's a leap too far. And I don't think we should connect dots without having reason to do so. Just because, you know, they could have been Chinese, they could have been German, they could have been Welsh, they could have been anything.
But in an airport, it always tends to be the same people, doesn't it? The same people pulled aside at security services. It's the same people that face disproportionate violence. Well, it's black and brown families.
Well, Ali, we don't know what happened before that altercation. All I will say to you in terms of judging that situation is that back in the day when I was a police officer, police officers were trained to use something called Home Office approved techniques. And I got into many, many altercations as a police officer in the town where I was policing. You know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights were, it was like going to war. And I never had to employ or was even tempted to employ something that was outside the techniques that the Home Office approves for arrest and restraint. And controlling people.
Okay,
now,
so
what I saw with that kick to their head, and what I saw with a stamp to the head, were two actions that are absolutely not Home Office approved. They don't come anywhere near it. That is not how you restrain somebody. It is not how you detain somebody. It's not how. It's just unprofessional policing, in my view. But what I can't say is why the police were called initially, what incident set that up about. I mean, you know, I've heard a few very vague stories, but certainly nothing that I would judge. So, no, I'm not prepared to say.
But look, Henry, this prompts a wider discussion. Let's put this individual incident to one side, because you're right, it's still being investigated and we can't prejudge an investigation before it's done. But the reality is, we have been speaking about policing on this show and other broadcasters have on other shows again and again, and the victims tend to be the same people again and again. And like I said, in 2023, Louise Casey's report clearly pointed to and said clearly that there was a problem of institutional racism in the police. You've highlighted training, which no doubt is a problem, but we can't solve a problem unless we acknowledge it. And surely you would acknowledge that it's the same victims again and again, it seems like, on the end of police brutality. It's black and brown people primarily, and there is clearly a problem of racism amongst the police in this country.
I think... You know, you're making two statements there, three. You're saying that the victims, we don't know what happened beforehand, and
not on this case. I'm talking about
officers were injured before those video clips. So
I'm talking about all the other cases, Henry.
It's Ali Malani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. Boot Bar Radio.
I think this is a good place to bring our guest Vicky Spratt in, the I newspaper's housing correspondent, who has written an article this week titled Why Britain's Birth Rate is Really Falling. Thank you so much for joining us, Vicky. Ali, do you want to repeat your question to Vicky?
Hi, Vicky. Thank you so much for joining us. We've just been talking about all the different variables young women face in the decision to have children, and Zoe has just spoken about some of the difficulties she faces in making that choice as a freelance journalist. What policies can we actually bring in place that allows women to make a freer decision about whether they're going to have children, given this falling birth rate?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I think this is probably one of the most important questions that policymakers face, because the birth rate in this country is falling faster than any other developed economy. New figures this week show. And I'm 36 and I don't have kids. And it's definitely something that's been on my mind, because the reality is I'm not set up to start a family. And I think you have to start with the basics, right? What do you need to have a family and keep your kids safe? You need affordable, secure housing. We've got a really, really big problem with housing affordability in this country. I actually got some exclusive data put together by Zoopla, the property listing site, recently, and they found that increasingly it's impossible for working people to be able to get a mortgage to afford to buy a house, not just in London, but across the country. So this is a problem that was impacting people on the lowest incomes, and it's now spread to people on middle incomes. And I think it's really difficult to contemplate having kids if you don't know if you are going to be able to afford your rent, if you're still living in a house share. You know, back in 1997, the most common way for young adults to live was in a home of their own. Now it's with their parents. So we urgently need some affordable housing that's secure. That could look different depending on what demographic you're aiming it at. You could build social housing. We've currently got a social housing waiting list of around 1 million households, and that figure stayed consistent in recent years. And obviously you need to get rid of that waiting list. So that would be for the lowest income households. But I think you need to start looking, and by you, I mean policymakers, not you two. I realize you're not responsible for this. They need to start looking at what they're going to do for people on middle incomes. Mm. I think we need some kind of affordable social housing offer now for the low to middle income bracket, because those people cannot get mortgages and they're spending so much of their take home pay on rent that it's really difficult to save for a deposit. But we don't currently have an offer like that. And I think that's a glaringly obvious thing that should be looked at, because the alternative is kind of fiddling with mortgage credit so that you can get young adults into more debt for longer to meet high house prices. But I'm increasingly worried about what the long-term impact of that will be on people's finances. Like, increasingly, it looks as though people who are taking out mortgages now will be repaying them into retirement. So home ownership will look a lot different if we keep extending the term of the borrowing to meet high house prices. Mm. So I think that's probably the most important thing. And I think it applies to low-income households and middle-income households. I think another aspect of this is the benefit system. Mm. I think for low income families, the two child benefit cap is really, really, really punitive. And I think it has definitely put a lot of people who maybe would have had another kid off having one. And let's face it, that was kind of the point of the policy. That's what they wanted to achieve. But what it means is that people aren't having children. Mm. And the economic consequences of that long term for Britain, and I should say, I mean, the human cost is obviously the most important thing, right? There's 300,000, 400,000 kids that are in poverty because of the cap are far more important than like the long term economic impacts. But we do have to think about that as well. And if we don't have a growing population, then we're not going to have any workers to pay tax to fund the care of our aging population, and that's going to be really serious in years to come.
Vicky, you described it in your great piece for The Eye, which I'd recommend everyone goes and reads, as a scenario a little like fiscal Armageddon. You say the result is a falling birth rate, population decline, and the very real prospect of Britain turning into a country where there are more pensioners requiring care and financial support than there are working age people. Really, is that the scenario? You think this could, if the birth rate continues to fall, and if you combine it with, you know, punitive immigration policies as well, what we are looking at is a system where old people who require care don't have enough young workers to support them.
It's already happening. We know that there are care homes that are struggling to recruit care workers, and that's such a vital job. I've been speaking to people who work in the NHS in places like Cornwall, where housing is really expensive, and they're saying that they're struggling to recruit for jobs like hospital porters. We urgently need people to be doing that work. Mm. So we are looking at a situation that is already emerging, and it will get worse. And we do have more old people than we have young people, and that means we have fewer workers paying into our social security system. Mm.
FUPAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SIS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, "What the fuck are those?" And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yeah. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
1 in 5 people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you. What's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
cray,
truth.
Cray.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
The best of 2024
on FUPAR Radio.
Now, the Prime Minister has apologised to the survivors and families of the people who died in the Grenfell Tower blaze on behalf of the British state. He said, quote, "When serious failings by those in charge happen over many years, the current Prime Minister, as head of government and behalf of the British state, can give an apology on behalf of previous governments as well as their own. It should never have happened," he said. It follows the release of an important report on the disaster, which happened 7 years ago on the 14th of June 2017, to find out what happened and who was responsible. The report says several parties were to blame for the fire, including governments, dishonest companies, the local council which oversaw the Grenfell Tower, and a lack of strategy by the fire brigade. 72 of the people living in the building lost their lives because of the fire, described as one of Britain's worst modern disasters. The report also gives recommendations on what needs to be done to avoid events like this from happening again. Police and prosecutors have been facing calls to bring criminal charges over the tragedy, but these won't begin until 2026 at the earliest. But speaking today, Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, has said prosecutions must happen as soon as possible. Well, joining us to discuss all this is Ahmed Shalat. Ahmed lost five relatives in the Grenfell Tower disaster and previously gave witness statements to the Grenfell Inquiry. Thank you so much for joining us, Ahmed. Now you've had some time to digest the findings. What are your reactions to what the inquiry has concluded?
Well, to be quite honest, it's the same reaction in the phase one. To be quite honest, it's obvious. The outcome is clear. And to be quite honest, disappointed of no one being charged. And the length of time they mentioned regarding, as you mentioned yourself, on the 26th, or what the minister said today, which I didn't have, it looks like they just pulling a rope to let it die. And it's a negative thing towards 72 people who lost their lives.
Ahmed, Ali here, assalamu alaikum. I just wanted to ask you quickly, the report is pretty damning, but I imagine nothing will begin to bring you and your family any level of closure or solace until you see those who are responsible for this held to account. Who are those people? Do you want to see it go as far as politicians, the actual companies involved? What do you want to see happen?
Some of them, I mean, they are names. They blame each other indirectly. Let me tell you this. It's obvious. Fire Brigade claiming is because of the cuts they got when one of the
coalition government,
whatever his name is, cut down on the fire brigade. The TMO, it's just a puppet of the council. They wanted, can you imagine? They wanted to save £600,000, and they spent millions in the carnival. So nothing being considered. And the report, the damning report regarding the TMO itself. So the systemic dishonesty is clear. So why do we have to wait till 2026 and or to 2027? The report state clearly who is to blame. So why do we have to wait? Do you understand?
Absolutely. Ahmed, you lost loved ones in the fire. And one of the things the inquiry conclusions pulled out was that the government were warned about this disaster, the potential of this disaster happening 25 years before it struck, with various other similar cases. But also we know that residents inside the building had been voicing their concerns for quite a long time. Do you know, were your family members concerned about their safety before the fire struck?
Well, let me tell you one thing. I had two families living there. One survived and one passed away, the demolished completely. My brother-in-law used to live in the 21st floor, which now it's moved to the 22nd. And my sister-in-law used to live in the 9th floor, which she survived herself and her two kids. All right? My sister-in-law was so involved in this issue of refurbishment, of complaints, of misbehavior, of misuse. The TMO never listened to them. And I am part of that state because I used to live in the same state. Greenfield is about 150 yards from where I live. So I'm part of the TMO was the voice of the council. So whatever the council wanted to keep away from, they give us the TMO to fight with. And it was obvious in the report that they blamed the TMO itself.
Yeah, Ahmed, can I ask you, the accusation that is being made here at home, which I really resonate to, is that we can't ignore the fact that part of the reason why so many warnings were ignored and such disregard to these people's lives has something to do with the fact that they were working class, the fact that they were very diverse, often in black and brown families that lived in Grenfell Tower. And basically what we're hearing is if Grenfell Tower had been in Chelsea and Fulham, this tragedy would never have happened. Is that something you agree with?
This has been going on for quite some time. Now, let me tell you exactly what happened. It's different than what we're saying. The first 3 days or four, a week after the disaster, is it, so, well, two reporters from LBC called me and they arranged a meeting with two women from Hillsborough disaster. One of them called Susan and the other one called Margaret. One lost her son and one lost her husband. Something like this, anyway. So what happened is they went through, I mean, Hillsborough disaster went through hell. They came and they explained three important things. First, the council would do its best to split up, which I've seen it within the family circles. And they will try to pull the blame away from them as much as they could, which is, I've seen it happen.
So they try to turn families on each other?
They did. Mm-hmm. And it's happened to my family. Personally, it's happened to me personally within my family circle. Because I didn't ask for nothing from the council. I only asked for justice. Mm-hmm. Because as far as I'm concerned, until now, those people were murdered. They were not killed. They were murdered in the most safest place in their lives. Mm. Right? So, and that's exactly what happened. What they did, on the top of that, which has made it worse, they approached the people. Most people who are now the council or the Grenfell voices got nothing to do with Grenfell. And that is, everybody should know this. Because they got these people, God knows, some of them don't have, they're not real believed. They just put them in the picture. And I can assure you this. And this is the council tactics. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, it's a building that contains a lot of foreigners, a lot of non-English speakers. And I'll tell you this. When we had meetings with them in parks with bereaved survivors, they were asking them to get lawyers, to get, they were shocked. They didn't understand how the system works. They didn't know what the inquiry means. They didn't know what the inquest means. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the council played a big, big game on these people, and they threw them peanuts. They split between them, and he's the winner.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
A proposed law to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales has been published. Under the bill, adults with less than 6 months to live would be given the right to end their own life. A doctor could prepare the substance, but the person themselves would take the final act. The person would need to meet several requirements, including approval from two independent doctors and a High Court judge. Campaigners say the law would stop the worst-case scenario of a horrific death. But others, including Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey, say they worry some people will feel pressure and as though they are a burden. MPs are due to debate and vote on the bill on the 29th of November, though further debates and votes would be needed before the bill became law. Keir Starmer says Labour MPs will be free to vote how they choose. Well, let's get a view from somebody who disagrees with assisted dying being made law in the UK. Joining us on the programme to discuss this is Paul Carroll, author of the book Shaking Hands with Elvis, a satirical look at what might happen if assisted dying was legalised in the UK. Paul had previously signed up to Dignitas, but changed his mind after researching the law in other countries for a book that he was writing. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. Let me start by asking you why you signed up for Dignitas and then what caused you to change your mind.
Yeah, it's a good question because a number of people have said, oh, were you ill when you signed up for Dignitas? And the fact is, I wasn't ill at all. My partner and I think we were doing our wills at the time. And it just seemed like an extra box to tick. We saw it as no more than, I suppose, an insurance policy against what might happen in the future. So, and I think what a lot of people would be surprised about is how easy it is to join Dignitas. You literally join online. It's a very simple form. You pay a one-off payment. And, you know, we just thought if we ever needed it down the line, it might just get us further ahead in the queue. It was no more than that. But then we went through three close family deaths in very short order. We went through COVID, which also had quite an influence on the writing of this book. But then when I decided to write a book about assisted dying, I was following in the book the paths of four individuals who were elected for an assisted death for a variety of reasons, including, yes, illness, but not all due to illness. And as a part of that, I did extensive research into countries around the world where assisted dying was already legal. And to be honest, that set so many alarm bells ringing. That's why I changed my mind. And that's why I think the assisted dying bill in the UK, as which is being debated on the 29th of November, could set a very, very dangerous precedent if it goes ahead, particularly in the form in which it's being currently framed.
Paul, can you talked about those alarm bells. Can you give us a few of what those are? Because I think a lot of people, generally when we introduce new laws that are sort of wide scale, we try to look to other countries and how it's going there and other people that have done the same. What are the alarm bells that you spoke about? Give us some highlights of what caused you concern and what made you change your mind.
Sure. I think Canada's probably the best example. They introduced assisted dying in 2016, so not that long ago. And it was the same pretty much conditions as being currently proposed, which is less than 6 months to live, with the usual, you know, claim safeguards of having to be signed off by doctors. That was soon challenged by people who were non-terminal, but nevertheless claimed that they had an equal right to end their lives. So, for example, they may have neurological illnesses. There may be an intolerable chronic pain and discomfort. And so they made illegal claims were made, and the law, the parameters were widened straight away. Then it's been subsequently challenged. So people are saying, well, mental disorders should be included in this bill. So when we look at the people who are applying, it may be people with depression, eating disorders. So we look at it in numerical terms. So, and again, it's interesting that the campaigners in the UK have not really talked about how many people this may affect. But for example, we're 8 years on from the introduction of the law in Canada. Currently, 4% of deaths are assisted. If we applied that, so you put a number on that. Well, that's 16,000 deaths a year, growing every year. If, as is proposed, people with mental illnesses and disorders and who want to end their lives qualify, and this is currently before the Canadian courts, we could be looking at, you know, doubling that number in maybe 3 or 4 years.
Paul, can I just interrupt? Sorry, mate, because look, I'm not well versed on this. I'm putting my hands up, right, so I'm learning a lot. So you're saying, am I correct in understanding you? 16,000 people a year in Canada are dying assisted through a doctor, right?
Yes.
And that includes non-terminal patients?
Yes, they've widened the rule. So you don't need this six-month terminal illness. And again, there is a split in the UK because the law is being proposed with the six-month terminal illness condition, and it has to be signed up by two doctors and a High Court judge, which in itself, within a six-month period, logistically and expense-wise, is very challenging. Mm. But there are other pro-assisted dying campaigners who are saying, well, hang on, that's not good enough. So people who are in favour of assisted dying are already disagreeing with each other. We are being told by the proponents of the bill that this has got the safest, strictest guidelines of any assisted dying bill in the world and won't be changed. But, of course, we know that any legal precedent can be challenged and changed.
FUPAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my Yes I Yes sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you. What's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
crying,
truth.
Crying.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
The best of 2024.
On FUBAR Radio.
Now, Commonwealth heads of government are preparing to defy the United Kingdom and agree plans to examine reparatory justice for the transatlantic slave trade. Downing Street insists the issue is not on the agenda for the summit of 56 Commonwealth countries, which begins in the Pacific Island nation of Samoa tomorrow. But diplomatic sources said officials will negotiate an agreement to conduct further research and begin a meaningful conversation about an issue which could potentially leave the UK owing not billions, but trillions of pounds in reparations. Well, earlier, I spoke to John Dower, a reparations campaigner and co-founder of the campaign group Heirs of Slavery, about why the conversation around slavery reparation needs to be had. Well, joining me now, I have John Dower, a reparations campaigner and co-founder of the campaign group Heirs of Slavery. John, thank you so much for joining us. I'm first going to ask you a little bit about the Trevelyan family, who saw publicly that they had been involved in more than 1,000 enslaved Africans, visited the Caribbean, apologized and paid reparations. Can you give our audiences a little bit of background of the journey that that took and what the Trevelyan family's decision was and what has happened since?
Thanks, Ali. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And it's great to be able to talk to your listeners and looks like viewers as well, given the fact I'm on camera. So 2016, I read an article in The Guardian by David Olushoga, the great black historian, who has really been doing some really groundbreaking work in terms of black history in the UK. And he said, if you're a middle class person, if you're descended from landed gentry, aristocracy, basically, if you are doing OK and you might see yourself as middle class, it's worth looking on the Legacies of Slavery database, which is being put together by University of College London. I think it had been digitized in 2014. So they essentially are all the records of the names of the enslaved and the families that received so-called compensation for the ownership of the ownership is also in inverted commas of the enslaved in 1834. So I went onto that database with some trepidation because I thought maybe my family, which I've always sort of heard is a very public facing, very philanthropic, public spirited family. Always my ancestors told me that we were on the side of the abolitionists if they ever talked about transatlantic trafficked enslaved people, trade of those people. And I put the word Trevelyan in, and lo and behold, up came six names and six plantations in Grenada, which they had part ownership of. And my world just kind of exploded because I suddenly realised I was not the person I thought I had been. And so that's where the journey started. I would encourage anybody listening who believes potentially their family might have been involved to go on that database, because they might be in for a surprise.
Can I stop you right there before you move to the next bit, which we're all really interested about? I want to know the personal impact of that, because so much of what I hear, I've talked about reparations on different political programs for a long time now, and I continuously hear, what's it got to do with us if our great-great-grandparents did something? But it seems like it had a profound personal impact on you finding out that your family had been involved in this. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, my great-grandfather, Charles Phillips Trevelyan, was in the Labour Party in the first cabinet in early 1920s, and he was Minister for Education. And the story I was always told by my family was that we did good things. You know, my grandmother was on the youth hostels board. My grandfather did important things in terms of introducing a white paper to set up the national parks. I'm just giving you an illustration. This is a family that I thought we were what you might call a good family.
Yeah, the story you told yourselves, the story that was told at the dinner table.
So when I discovered that we were something different, that we had derived income, and my ancestors had basically hidden that under the carpet, I just realised that my family, my ancestors, had been hypocrites, and I went on I guess you might call it a crusade, but it's been a very profound experience for me to realise I'm actually not who I thought I was, i.e. I am a descendant of people that owned enslaved people, and that I am, therefore, I have derived privilege from that. And I think that's what's really, really shocked me and has taken me on this journey.
And then what decisions did you guys make coming out of that?
So it took around 7 years. We didn't really coalesce until 2022. The things that happened in between were the Colston statue was knocked down, George Floyd was murdered, Black Lives Matter marches went on. We were in the middle of the pandemic. A lot of my family started to watch the telly and realised that racism was alive and kicking. I mean, I knew that, but I think many of them were not necessarily convinced of the severity of the situation. And that then galvanised us to start having Zoom meetings as a family and then put together an apology letter, which we delivered to the people of Grenada in February 2023.
Uh-huh. And what about reparations, and was any payments made or what happened?
Yes. So we offered at the time £100,000, which we essentially said to the Grenadian government, what would you like to do with this? And we subsequently set up a charity called the Trevelyan Education Charity, Grenada Education Charity, which is funding programs, education programs in Grenada.
Uh-huh. And so, John, this brings us to where we are now, because the conversation nationally happening now, particularly with the conference happening, I think it's in Samoa, in the islands of Samoa, and post-BLM and other things, there's huge conversations around reparations. Your family recognised the part that they played in one of the greatest crimes in human history in the slave trade, and have made steps towards both apology and reparations. Our government is refusing to do that. We've heard Keir Starmer say he kind of wants to look forward, doesn't want to look back, has ruled out reparations, has ruled out a formal apology. Why is an individual family able to do that, but a government isn't?
Well, that's a big question. And actually, interestingly, it sounds as though the government are beginning to cave a little bit, in that they've just announced that they might talk about non-financial help. Why is it? Well, a family, I suppose, is a smaller unit with less responsibility. The government is a massive organisation, obviously, and it's a very poignant and significant act for it to make an apology, as we did. But I would argue that make an apology they must, because for too long the descendants of the enslaved have been ignored. They've been calling for justice. They've been treated appallingly, and I think the government need to start to talk to them. Now, one of the really important things to establish here is that reparations don't automatically equals money. Uh-huh. It starts with an apology. It starts with a recognition that a wound was caused and the responsibility lies with the government and the royal family, particularly because they are the organisations that sanction so much of this.
Yeah, I think so. The conversation we always hear is it's so far long away, and why does this generation pay for the past's mistakes? So my view is, and agree or disagree with me, your family have kind of taken the journey that I think is natural for a moral human being to take, which is, look, our country is we're the sixth largest economy in the world, one of the richest nations in the world. That's undoubtedly due to empire and colonialism and slavery, and so we continue to benefit from that crime, and so should make amends in any way that we can, whether it's an apology, debt cancellation, or reparations. That's the journey your family has taken on. The country should surely take the same journey.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And to be frank, I think we are getting to a stage now, particularly with the Commonwealth countries, and this being the first significant meeting that the King's had with the Commonwealth since coming on the throne. I think this is going to be a really big moment. And we're at this moment in time because black reparationists have been campaigning for a long time. If you go back in the last 20, 30 years, apartheid was ended. This is the very important database, which I think is very significant, that I referred to earlier on, has proved beyond doubt people's and families and individuals and institutions' involvement in the trade. And the King has said himself, for example, that he's going to put money into research and he's going to come out with the findings, I think, next year. I mean, it really isn't that complicated for him to go back and actually see the reality of the royal family's involvement.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
The government has relaunched the Football Governance Bill in the House of Lords today with a number of changes to the initial bill first launched in March. The original bill failed to progress through Parliament before July's general election, but has now been brought back by the Labour government. The bill will establish an independent football regulator with the ability to implement a backstop measure which could be used should the Premier League and the EFL not find agreement over funding. The regulator will also be fully independent and will no longer be obliged to consider foreign policy and trade when ruling on who can own a football club. Well, joining us to discuss this and more is Araman Banerjee, Head of Football Governance at consultancy firm Lane, Clark and Peacock. Araman, thank you so much for joining us. Can I first ask you, who currently regulates football in this country?
Well, first of all, Ali, thank you for having me on. That is a big question because technically we already do have a regulator for football, for English football, in the form of the Football Association. That is traditionally its role, and in theory and on paper, that is still the role of the FA. However, what we've seen since the formation of the Premier League is that over the last 30-odd years, that the Football Association has slowly lost its grip on the regulation of football, and that's been usurped. That power has been usurped by the Premier League. So what you get then is a situation where the tail wags the dog and the Premier League begins to regulate football in the interests of its 20 members rather than in the interests of the wider game. Now, that becomes increasingly problematic when you think about within the Premier League at the moment. We have a very fractionalized system, lots of different groups, lots of different cliques there. So even within the body that has taken power, you have different objectives. And that is why we reach a situation where the governance systems are so poor in this country when it comes to football. That's when you get things like a European Super League. That's when you get the slew of administrations that we've seen amongst football clubs in recent years. And that's why there have been calls for this independent regulator to be introduced.
And so what would this new Football Governance Bill hope to achieve? Is it about bringing this independent regulator to kind of put a check on particularly the Premier League? Because if we're all honest, this all came out of the European Super League. That's what reignited all of this. Is the aim to kind of put a final stopgap measure in case things like the Super League happen again? What's the hope? What's the aim? What's the objective?
Yeah, so that is one of the objectives, and that is very clearly outlined both in the previous bill under the Conservative government and under the Labour government, that there is a block on breakaway competitions and English clubs joining breakaway competitions. The other key objective is, of course, to stop the culture of financial unsustainability that currently exists within English football. What you have are English football clubs, cornerstones of local communities, real community assets being run into the ground, being run into administration, and in very tragic cases, liquidation as well. And the aim of this regulator is to shore that up and to ensure that we have a culture of financial sustainability across the board, which means that those sorts of scenarios are no longer the case, and we are not gambling anymore with the future of community assets in the form of football clubs. In order to do that, a number of regulations have been proposed that will be implemented by this regulator when it comes in, everything from new corporate governance codes to new checks on owners and directors and annual financial and strategic reports that will have to be submitted to this regulator. And the hope is with that addition in terms of red tape, we will be able to have a more financially solvent industry overall.
So I'm really glad you spoke about football clubs as community assets, because that at my heart is, I think, fundamental to our game, to the league and to this country. Football clubs all across the country are such important community assets, cultural assets. They're some of the most important part of people's lives. I think sometimes people who aren't football fans don't understand just how important people's football teams are to them. And there are a huge amount of risks that didn't exist 20 years ago that exist today. Things like sports washing, foreign state ownership of football clubs, things like what's being called the Americanization of football, which is a direct challenge to the football pyramid and to the competitiveness of our league. Are these things that this regulator and this bill can tackle, or is that beyond the scope?
Well, no, particularly with regards to sports washing. Under the previous bill, what we saw was that when a new owner or director came in to try and buy a football club, that it could be sold to someone with potentially strong state links, which is obviously what's happened in the past with Newcastle United and Manchester City, because the regulator would have to take into account state and foreign policy objectives when deciding whether or not to block a move.
So, yeah, and so example, if we use Newcastle as an example here, I think you might have just been about to go into it. There were rumours and discussions that the government at the time picked up the phone and made phone calls and discussions based on the government at the time's foreign policy and trade objectives. That will no longer be the case.
No, under this new bill, it will no longer be the case. That is one of the changes that have come under this new bill, as you quite correctly allude to. And I don't think these are rumours anymore. Boris Johnson was told that the trading relationship between Britain and Saudi Arabia would suffer if the Premier League did not approve the bid for Newcastle United. And so, it's not to say that we won't still have state ownership and we won't still have sports washing, but on a case-by-case basis, when the regulator makes a decision on whether an owner is appropriate or not to take over an English community asset, it will no longer have to take into consideration the foreign and trade policy objectives that have, I think, to the detriment of the game, been analysed in the past as part of that process.
Mm-hmm. And would this new regulator be able to put a foot down and stop a European Super League from happening in the future? Because when the Super League happened, there was huge amounts of backlash and fan protests, and clubs had to end up apologizing to fans and rowing back. But there are still rumors and murmurs that this idea continues to be on the table. Certainly, if Florentino Perez has anything to do with it, my club's owners, the Glazers, who still hang around like a bad smell, if they have anything to do with it, they'll want to see it. So would this regulator be able to stop a European Super League?
So it wouldn't be able to stop the concept of a European Super League, because that can exist, of course, outside Britain. What it would be able to do, and what it has done successfully in this legislation, is place a block on English clubs being able to join that Super League. That is very clear in the legislation. That is something that has been at the core of this process of reform. And as you say, a lot of this was stimulated from the European Super League arising in 2021. And so, no, it wouldn't be able to stop the idea of a European Super League. If Florentino Perez wants to go on and form one, then he's very welcome to try.
Yeah.
But what we can say is that English clubs will not be involved.
And that's, I think that'll be good news to a lot of football fans out there. How have the Premier League reacted to this?
So that's a very interesting question. The Premier League have been notoriously cool about this since it was proposed, since the idea of a regulator was proposed, naturally having accrued so much authority and power over the last 30 years. It doesn't readily want to give that up to a new independent regulator. We've seen a statement from them today, which is very much still in line with what they've said previously, that perhaps there are elements of this that the Premier League could support, but fundamentally they have gross concerns is about what this could do to the wider football industry.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.